intended as a friendly thing. In Glasgow, they just chuck their pints everywhere if they're having a good time. James, he took it the wrong way, and he threatened to kill this guy in the front row. It was like, oh my god, this guy is taking on a Glasgow audience. Like, he's got balls. Phil Mossman. That show was interesting. We pulled up into Glasgow on the bus, and Rangers had just beaten Celtic over the whole season by like one goal. The whole town just erupted into fucking uber violence. Like sectarian football violence everywhere. Protestant and Catholic as well. Just driving through the town, you'd see fighting in the streets, bottling each other, things just kicking off. So the sound check was done, and everyone was like, should we go and get something to eat? And as the only Brit, I was like, listen, please do not fucking go outside. Do me a favor. I remember Tyler was like, I'm gonna go for a run. He was putting shorts on and his running shoes. He got fucking half a block and came right back. Someone had already beaten someone up and the guy was unconscious leaning up against a bus stop. Tyler was just like, okay, no jogging today. But then the show was amazing. Alex Kapranos. Obviously, this music we were listening to on the dance floor for all these years, that's what we wanted to play as well. Imran Ahmed. I remember Franz Ferdinand had this line about their aim being to make records that girls dance to, and to cut through postured crap. It was very sharp, and you could hear their records in the same clubs that played LCD Sound System. They took their cue from the Strokes and LCD, and became the UK arm of that NYC DFA ethos. Guitar music you could dance to. It made the whole scene so much more fun than it had been in years. Paul Banks. With Franz Ferdinand, I heard an EP before the first record. Daniel had heard it first. Alex Kapranos. That's when it all really collided, when we opened up for Interpol really early on. Daniel Kessler. That was in the summer of 2003. It was before their record came out. It was before Take Me Out, for sure. They were playing it in their set, but it wasn't a hit yet. Paul Banks. Oh, they were amazing. It was really nice. It wasn't something where there was, like, this sense of we're being upstaged. It wasn't that. Well, it was and it wasn't. Sam Fogarino. Small venues in Europe, on the Bright Lights tour. That was fun. Paul Banks. We got along. But at that point, I was in full-blown party mode. So I don't remember having too many intellectual conversations. I was pretty fucked up. And Alex and I didn't... It's not that we didn't hit it off. I just think that maybe we were similar personality types. I'm not about to be the guy to go up to him and be like, let's be friends. And he's the same. So maybe we would have both really liked each other. But we didn't really get there. I do remember seeing the drummer in the dressing room one day with a smoking hot girl. I don't know if she was an exotic dancer or something, but it was his girlfriend. He was like a guy in, I don't want to say a Guy Ritchie film, but whoever Guy Ritchie is inspired by, an old British cinema gangster guy from the 60s or 70s, but in real life. Not a big guy, and definitely a very nice guy, but you just had this feeling like, I do not want to fuck with that guy. That guy will knock all your teeth out, then go play an amazing rock show like John fucking Bonham, then go bang four strippers and not sleep for 2 days. Mark Ronson. I remember the first time I heard a Franz Ferdinand song was at a Stroke show before they went on. It was that Central Park show when they played Summer Stage. I remember hearing Take Me Out. Obviously, they're a great band. And would have found their way. But if the Strokes hadn't existed, maybe they wouldn't have had as much exposure. James Endicott. Alex is a little bit older and slightly more calculated, and they had been around a little bit. They did take elements of the Strokes. In the first record, there are a lot of Strokesisms. But it's more measured. It was almost like an exercise in art rock. Alex Kapranos. There was something that I quite liked about a lot of the bands that were appearing at that time as well. You definitely had it with Interpol. You had it with the Strokes. You had it with the White Stripes. You had it with the Hives. It wasn't just a bunch of guys getting together to play music. There was some thought behind it. That's why you get that journalistic cliché phrase, fully formed. It's not fully formed. We've still got things to do. But we've actually thought about what we're going to do before we've done it. Rob Sheffield. Franz Ferdinand thought, wow, look at all these New York bands taking all our Britpop tricks and selling them back to us. We're going to go do it with better songs. They did it with better songs. And they were a better band. They're still a better band. I mean, Alex Kapranos was in a fucking ska band called the Amphetamines before Franz Ferdinand. And then he heard the Strokes and Interpol and was like, well, what the fuck am I doing this for? We're going to do Britpop, and we're going to go to New York, and girls are going to scream and throw their underwear. And that's exactly what they did. I saw them at North 6 for the first time, and it was like Beatlemania in real life. Chapter 51. These guys are going to be bigger than everybody. Mark Spitz. Yeah Yeah Yeahs didn't want to do press. The Strokes didn't want to do press. Their dreams were coming true and they weren't looking the way that they imagined. They were bewildered. There was a sense of bewilderment with the Strokes that Jack White didn't have, that the Hives didn't have, and that the Killers certainly didn't have. It's a certain wiring. You have to be Nick Drake and you have to be Liam Gallagher in the same package. You have to be a real sensitive artist person, and you have to say, bring it. Bring the fucking horde on. I'm going to lead it.
Laura Young. The Strokes become the stepping stone for doing something else. So when a band like the Killers or whoever comes along where they're kind of Strokesy, but they're a little bit more commercial, they're a little bit more poppy, but they've got good songs, got good songwriting. Now the labels know how to market that shit. They know who to market it to. That band is no longer a concept that you have to understand or have to figure out. You're familiar with it, and you're familiar with who buys it, so it becomes an easier sell.
Mark Spitz. The band that wanted it, and were fucking ready for it, were the Killers. Brandon Flowers. There was a drought not just in Las Vegas, but in music before the White Stripes and the Strokes and Franz Ferdinand came and injected a little bit of style back into rock and roll. I mean, it was bad. And Vegas was particularly bad. Harmar Superstar. The Killers guys are all nice. Brandon was always super nice. He knew that they were going to blow up really hard. I think he purposely didn't do anything crazy or offensive or get on anyone's nerves, because he knew he was going to get hated on at some point for being in the biggest band. At first it was like, these guys are really good. Then all of a sudden it was like, oh, there's no question these guys are going to be bigger than everybody. Ronnie Vannucci. We work hard. I've been in tons of other bands, and no one wanted to work as hard as I did, until I met these crazy assholes. Of course, now they're fat and lazy. Brandon Flowers. When I met Dave Kooning, our guitar player, I was working in a restaurant, a brasserie, and then the Aladdin Hotel. Ronnie Vannucci. Dave was actually a lot crazier back then. He wore these weird moon boots.
Sarah Lewitton. Dave was going by the name Tavia Go at the time. I have no idea why. Dave's awkwardness is like a vortex in the room. And then Brandon's awkwardness is this whole different beast, where he's like Mickey Mouse discovering things for the first time. They were like children.
Ronnie Vannucci. Brandon looked like kid David Bowie.
Sarah Lewitton. The only person that could engage people in conversation was Ronnie.
Brandon Flowers. I used to go to Forum Shops in Caesar's Palace. It's like the best mall on the earth. They had a Virgin megastore, and I used to spend a lot of time in there because it was exciting. It was the only place in town you could get the NME and Q magazine. They had imports, and they had this wall that had the top 40 records on it with headphones and stations for listening. It was just heaven for me. Ronnie Vannucci. I was a wedding photographer at the time, on the Strip. And I was in school full-time, studying music at UNLV. The first time I met Brandon, I got a call. It was the last day of school, and I had a brand new cell phone. One of those little red Nokias. I remember thinking, whoa, it's my first call. It was my roommate, Anne, our mutual friend. The Killers' drummer couldn't do this last-minute gig, so we played a show together. They were great. Brandon was just totally unafraid. He was more of a screamer back then, less of a smooth-as-silk kind of guy. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, said, they like the shit you like. You should be in their band. The first record I ever bought was The Head on the Door by The Cure, and I knew all about Depeche Mode. I even permed my hair at one point because of Martin Gore. I looked like a French poodle. The point being, I like rock and roll. So do they. Brandon Flowers. I read about the Strokes in Q magazine, and I saw their picture, and just hearing the way that they were described was exciting. I was lucky I found that first EP. That Virgin Megastore actually had an import of the Modern Age EP, the one with the target on it. I showed it to Dave, and we were really into it. Ronnie Vannucci. Brandon and Dave, they liked Bowie. And at the time in Vegas, nobody liked Bowie. Nobody wanted to be like that. People wanted to wear trucker hats. Brandon Flowers. It felt like Julian had a lot of the same influences that I had, but it was all through Manhattan, not Vegas. Nick Valenci. We had similar influences, but they took a certain group of those influences and wore it on their sleeve a lot clearer than we ever wanted to. More sparkly and less subtle. Ronnie Vannucci. I remember hearing Is This It? I was like, oh, it's cool. It's got such a cool sound. Who turned down the bass? Why does this sound like it's coming out of a rat's asshole? It sounds like headphone bleed, but it sounds great. They didn't give a fuck, and I like that. Brandon Flowers. I felt like the Strokes were kindred spirits, even though I'd never met them. It was exciting that someone was doing it, and it was depressing because they were doing it so well. But that feeling didn't set in until Is This It came out. At first I was like, okay, I've heard their first offering on this EP, but I'll buy the record, and it'll be whatever. Then the record destroyed the EP. I genuinely felt depressed for months. Ronnie Vannucci. Brandon and Dave gave me a demo CD, and it had Mr. Brightside, Replaceable, and a song called Newsman on it. Brandon Flowers. The only song that we kept was Mr. Brightside. Everything else that we had we knew wasn't good enough. So we started building again. The Strokes helped me realize that I wasn't good enough yet. Ronnie Vannucci. The temperature of what was going on at the time was the complete opposite of what we were trying to do. We looked different, we played different, we were sort of unashamed of all of it and just totally went for it and didn't give a fuck. We'd play a sports bar with 13 people in it, and we'd act like it was Wembley. Brandon Flowers. You're trying to keep the ear to the ground, and then you hear about the Libertines and Franz Ferdinand. Obviously something was happening. And it was really exciting, but it was also scary because you didn't know if there was going to be room for you.
Sarah Lewitton. Brandon and I used to talk on the phone all the time. People weren't texting or emailing each other. If you wanted to talk to someone, you gave them a call. He was obsessed with the Strokes. Actually, he was obsessed with everybody that was in a band. I remember he could not believe that Karen knew Carlos and that Carlos said he would maybe mention a Killers song in something he was writing somewhere. Anyone we introduced Brandon to, he would already know everything about them.
Harmar Superstar. Brandon always seemed like he was always in the background, studying. Ronnie Vannucci. At that point, we'd written Jenny Was a Friend of Mine and On Top, and then we sort of reworked Mr. Brightside. We'd written All These Things That I've Done, and Somebody Told Me, and we started playing places that were up our alley. We played this place called Tramps, which was a tranny bar most of the time. Brandon Flowers. There was a Vegas website called lvlocalmusicscene.com, and it made you want to make a demo because you could put three songs and a picture and a paragraph about you on the site. That's how Braden Merrick, our first manager, found us.
Sarah Lewitton. No one had music online, that's the thing. There was no MySpace yet. If you had a song up on your site, that was a project, you know? So I found this website and it was like thekillersband.com. They had one song up. I was listening to Dexy's Midnight Runners, Come On Eileen, on my headphones, and I remember thinking, I'm stopping Come On Eileen to listen to this song, and if this song is not as good as Come On Eileen, I'm going to be really upset. I press play, and 15 seconds into hearing Jenny Was a Friend of Mine, I was like, I am-ing Rob Stevenson from Island, who'd asked me to check them out in the first place. You have to sign this band. They're the best band ever. He was like, everyone's passing. I was like, everyone's an idiot.
Ronnie Vannucci. Braden was a scout for Warner Bros., and he got us a showcase in L.A. Seymour Stein was there, and Tom Wally was there. All these big industry executive types. We knew who Seymour Stein was, but we didn't know who Tom Wally was. Oh, he's the president of Warner Bros.? Oh, cool. It was the first money I've ever made in the music industry. I got a $25 check. I was like, it's 25 bucks. I could really use it right now, but I'm not going to cash it. I still have it. Brandon Flowers. All the major labels turned us down in America. Ronnie Vannucci. I don't think we even stayed in L.A. We had rented gear, and I think we flew back the same night. It was a really weird gig. Tom Wally said, nah, no. Same with Seymour Stein. But there was this one English dude there who said, what the fuck? Sure. He just started up this little tiny label called Lizard King. Brandon Flowers. We knew the story of the White Stripes and the Strokes and how it started in England, so we thought maybe we were lucky that we had that chance. In September of 2003, they flew us over and we played four gigs. We got great write-ups in NME, and that was it. Everything changed. Connor McNicholas. I went to their first ever gig in the UK. It was at Dublin Castle in Camden. Brandon, with his great spangly keyboard and a couple of bored people standing at the front, saying, what the fuck is this? They had keyboards, and nobody was allowed to have keyboards. The rules had just been set. Bands had guitars. It was two guitars, maybe one. Drum, vocal, bass, that's it, sunshine. None of this fucking crazy keyboard shit. We're not back to Paul Oakenfold. But they turned up with keyboards and melody. They brought melody to the party in a way nobody else had done. Ronnie Vannucci. You had to go to England so that the States would know you're cool. Connor McNicholas. There was a second wave where the majors had woken up by that point. With the Killers, it was almost instantaneous. Ronnie Vannucci. We got in under the wire, foot in the door right before it closed. We were in England for like a week. We played four or five gigs, and of course, when we came back, every record label in the States said, can we take you out? We ate really well for 2 months. In this business, everybody's just guessing. Matt Pinfield. They were still pretty young and naive at the time, but their songs were so great. Ronnie Vannucci. We knew we were going to get a record deal, but we also knew that record deals can be bespoke. They can be a custom-fit thing just for you. There are so many horror stories of bands getting reamed, and we were working-class dudes. We all worked in hotels off the strip somewhere. We knew, just from instinct, not to take the first fucking banana in front of you. So the deals got sweeter and sweeter. And to be honest, we were just really enjoying the whole prospect of it all, just eating at nice restaurants, meeting all these great people. We were all in our 20s. We were eager. It was crazy.
Sarah Lewitton. Rob told me not to send her music to anybody. I don't want other people to know about them before I see them. And I was like, no problem. And then I emailed Jenny Was a Friend of Mine to everybody I knew. That should have been a sign about how people should be doing A&R in the internet age, which is like, don't hold the thing as precious, just fucking let it run.
Brandon Flowers. She was a fan. She got the music and she was waving our flag. You can't put a price on that.
Sarah Lewitton. I sent their music to all the bloggers and all the young girls that were going to shows. So when they played Don Hills in New York, before they got signed, there were all these girls up front singing along to every song. People who passed on them were wondering, what the fuck is going on?
Rob Sheffield. They would come to town and they'd be such stars. I mean, New York made them. Made them. Brandon Flowers. Being from Vegas, I was intimidated by New York. I'm still intimidated by New York. It's New York.
Sarah Lewitton. They were like children, but they also had this competitive edge, especially Brandon. I was also best friends at the time with Brandon Riley from this band Nightmare of You, and Brandon Flowers was, like, somewhat upset that I knew another Brandon that was also trying to be a rock star. Seriously.
Harmar Superstar. Brandon is also not as much of a partier.
Sarah Lewitton. They didn't drink a lot. They weren't that fucked up. It was just their profound, unbelievable awkwardness that made them seem like they were on drugs.
Rob Sheffield. I assumed the Killers were a very cokey band. They sounded very cokey.
Sarah Lewitton. I remember the first time the Killers were in Spin, in the Next Big Thing issue. I had chosen all the bands and wrote about how Brandon was like a fallen Mormon because he drank and smoked a little or whatever. He called me and was like, "I can't believe you said that. I can't show my mom." But I never remember him doing drugs. I did them in front of him one time, and he got really upset by that. We were at a Misshapes, and I had a little bag of coke. I had a Parliament cigarette with that little carved-in filter, which I stuck up my nose, and he said, "You shouldn't be doing that." And I was like, "Shove it."
Harmar Superstar. He would amusedly observe, have a beer or whatever. That's why they're bigger than all of us who enthusiastically enjoyed the spoils of war. Ronnie Vannucci. Nobody really got too deep into all that. I had an uncle that ended up dying from drugs. He overdosed. I knew, hey, don't be an asshole. Have a good time, but don't fuck everything that moves. Be cool. Be a gentleman, but have a good time. We all had that mindset.
Sarah Lewitton. Brandon's drug is music. Pure obsession. We used to pore over issues of NME looking at what people ate.
Ronnie Vannucci. We were always a little bit on the outside. Harmar Superstar. Julian wanted to be like Guided by Voices, but by the time you get to the Killers, they knew there was more to be had.
Sarah Lewitton. Brandon wanted it. I don't think he ever knew the difference between being in a tiny little band playing to five people and being David Bowie, because everyone he could read about in a magazine was David Bowie to him. He had that hunger that comes from just not knowing anything else.
Brandon Flowers. I don't know if I ever settled into the scene. I don't know if I was comfortable with it, because I was such a fan of those guys that paved the way, so it made it hard. Harmar Superstar. I remember seeing their poster on the side of the Whiskey in L.A. It was there for 2 years, a giant wall-sized poster for their first album. I was like, they're banking a lot on this. And 6 months later, it was multi-platinum.
Laura Young. Take it out of the context of music and think about it in, like, technology and business. It's the same thing. At this time, you have MySpace and Friendster. Oh, those Friendster dudes totally screwed the pooch on that one. It's never the first person that does it that succeeds. Obviously, the Killers made a shit ton more money than the Strokes ever will. It's about seeing the Strokes, and then the Killers coming from where they come from and being a little bit savvier about how they ran their business and their deals.
Ronnie Vannucci. We come from the West Coast, you know? I just had a conversation with a person that grew up in New York in an affluent home with just excess, excess, excess. We didn't have that. We had fucking horse shit and gun smoke, you know what I mean? It's Vegas. My mom was a cocktail waitress, my dad was a bartender. Where we come from, service industry, working class, we heard stories about the celebrities and how they'd act. My parents would come home with stories of Sammy Hagar stiffed us, or Steven Tyler as an asshole. So that was always in the back of my mind. If somebody gives you good service, give them a nice tip. It doesn't matter where you are. That will always be there. I still know the value of $20. I'm rich now, but I'm still poor.
Part 3.
The New Global Underground. Chapter 52. The End of One Era, the Beginning of Another. Alex Kapranos. The first place we ever played in New York was that back room at Pianos on the Lower East Side. There were these posters all around the venue that said, "Thank you for not dancing." It seemed so perverse to us. Like we got this band together because we wanted to make people dance. After every song, I remember saying to the crowd, "Thank you for not dancing. Tunde Edebimpe. You had to have a cabaret license for people to dance." Dominique Keegan. At Plant Bar, we got our first cabaret violation back at the end of 2001. Tunde Edebimpe. You'd see those signs and it seemed like a joke. Like the Death Star or the Empire was coming down on you. There was no way people were going to comply. Luke Jenner. It was fucking retarded. James Haubacker. I very intentionally did not become a cop. That was a choice. So to be asked to police my own crowd? I wasn't going to do that. Dominique Keegan. The rule was, you can't have any more than 6 people dancing. James Haubacker. Back in the 90s, when I had Plush, we totally lucked out because Giuliani decided just at that moment that he was only going to allow cabaret licenses in certain little districts, and the meatpacking was one of them. It was all hookers and literal meatpacking. They didn't care. It was easy. I went down myself to Consumer Affairs and filled out the paperwork and got us a cabaret license. I mean, this was still in the days where in order to get approval from the fire department, we bribed people in cash. That kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. Dominique Keegan. The whole thing originally comes from a 1926 law. James Haubacker. It actually started with LaGuardia. Before LaGuardia was mayor, there were slot machines in all the candy shops. It was a very different city. He took all that out. Took out all the Nickelodeons and set up these cabaret laws. You have to have a license both for dancing and for music. Charlie Parker couldn't play in New York because he was a drug addict. Birdland was named after him, but they refused to give him a musician's license, so he could not play here. Then, in the 70s, there was a group that managed to defeat that aspect of the cabaret laws. But the dancing law was still on the books. Nick Mark. It was basically a racist law in the first place, because it was to cut down on jazz clubs in Harlem. James Haubacker. So it had been on the books all along, but no one applied it until Giuliani was elected. Giuliani came out of the Knapp Commission. He was a federal prosecutor. The Knapp Commission began this investigation into corruption in the New York City Police Department, and he was one of the big dogs involved in all this. That's where he made his career, with Serpico and Lindsay. Basically, he was the biggest gangster, and when he got to be mayor, he decided that nobody was going to be taking a dollar. You couldn't pay off the elevator guy. You used to be able to get anything done, and it got done quickly. But after Giuliani, suddenly it became this whole bureaucratic thing. He saw it as a way to make a lot of money. It wasn't any less corrupt. It's still a grift. You're still handing them tons of money, but it's going to the city.
Tricia Romano. They hated nightlife.
James Haubacker. Plush was a total drug den. I never dealt drugs, but everyone was doing coke. It was just a mess, but it was a fun mess. And we never got hassled. Then I opened up the Slipper Room, and it just hassled us unbelievably. We couldn't get a cabaret license. It was a lot harder than it had been in 1994.
Tricia Romano. They actually had an agency inside the city dedicated to shutting clubs down.
James Haubacker. The Nightlife Task Force would come around, cops, the fire department, they'd have the Environmental Control Board there, and they'd just go through the place. They would always come on a Friday or Saturday, of course, shining flashlights in everyone's face. Dominique Keegan. The first time we got a ticket, I was DJing. I was playing Prince's Kiss. The guy came in undercover, ordered a Coke, and we had to go to court.
Tricia Romano. They used the cabaret law to shut down places that had a DJ in the corner, like Plant Bar, where you'd go see James Murphy DJ, or people like him. That's what was really sad. It was putting a stake through the heart of that world.
Luke Jenner. I used to go to work at the bar and it would be fucking padlocked. Dominique Keegan. We tried to stop people dancing. We put up our no dancing signs and we enforced the no dancing rule, and the business started really suffering. Simon Reynolds. We just thought it was absurd. Dominique Keegan. We had a little blue light switch at the front of the bar, and all the DJs were instructed to put on a Radiohead record if that light went on. The idea was that because of the bottleneck, by the time anyone got from the front to the back of the bar, you could stop the dancing by playing Kid A. James Haubacker. It was arbitrary and capricious, and if you weren't careful, they would just put you out of business. Dominique Keegan. Luke called me one night and said, "The place is crawling with cops. They're padlocking the place. You better get down here." It was one of James's birthday parties. Tim was DJing, and he had never been briefed on the rule with the light. I had moved out of the upstairs apartment by that point, for my own sanity. I jumped on my bike and rode down there. The marshals were padlocking the gate. Luke was scared shitless. I called our lawyer. After that, we were open for another month. I should have just driven it into the ground until they closed us down. It was kind of an end of an era. I should have just let it go. It was over. Luke Jenner. They put up a really nice high-rise next door. That's what killed me about Plant Bar. They put this really expensive high-rise next door. And that's why everyone moved to Williamsburg. Chapter 53. The Famous as Fuck Strokes. Julian Casablancas. Albert said he was going to move across the street, and it was like, okay, I'll move in with you. Albert Hammond Jr. This was Is This It money.
Catherine Pierce. I love moving. I was like, I'll set us up appointments to look at apartments. I called and set up all these appointments, and then Julian just said, we're moving across the street. There's a massive, gorgeous building across the street. It was like, all right, we're moving across the street.
Ryan Adams. 2nd Avenue and 18th Street, the Rutherford Building, the Haunted Children's Hospital. Adam Green. 2nd Avenue is for some reason a very conducive place. For 10 years I lived there, on 17th between 2nd and 3rd, and Julian and Albert lived right there too. And then Ryan Adams lived there. Mark Ronson grew up there. It was a weird corner. Ryan Adams. We all frequented the same pasta place. We were all getting spaghetti bolognese at the same place. Or carbonara. The carbonara was unbelievable. And they were open 24 hours. Jesse Mallon. I met Ryan because he was at a degeneration gig in Raleigh. This is when he was in Whiskeytown. We started talking music. Bad Brains, Replacements, Sonic Youth, Neil Young. I realized we share a lot of stuff in common, so we stayed in touch. He'd call me up in the middle of the night, I'm writing songs, and I'd think, this kid's got so much energy and enthusiasm. We don't do that in New York. Nobody calls anybody up that excited. Caleb Followill. I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was going to a writer's night to listen to songwriters. I was sitting there having a drink when, holy shit, I realized that's Ryan Adams. There was this pretty girl talking to him, and then I realized, holy shit, that's Winona Ryder. I kind of became starstruck for him, not for her. Like, this dude is doing it right. He's a natural. He's at this shitty little bar, and he's got Winona Ryder with him. That's crazy. And that's what I want. Jesse Mallon. He came back from Nashville after he made Heartbreaker, was living in New York again. And we were pretty much out every night. You'd be at Niagara, and Ryan would be writing a song in one corner. Alan Light. He was in some weird phase, writing letters to Jack White about how he was mad about something about Meg. Ben Blackwell. He dedicated one of his albums to Meg White for saving rock and roll. Mark Spitz. We all loved Heartbreaker. We all loved his follow-up, Gold. And then he became known for things other than the music. There were rumors that he was dating a bunch of famous people, and there were rumors that he was a junkie, and there were rumors that he had recorded a cassiotone version of Is This It, like note for note. Ryan Adams. I was trouble on wheels back then. Jesse Mallon. When Ryan came here, he had such a romantic heart. He really connected to the romance and classic style of New York. Everything from the Jewish, neurotic Woody Allen to food, architecture, to bonding with the Strokes and hanging out all night. Austin Skaggs. I would see Ryan Adams at the bar, you know? Ryan Gentles. Ryan was such a New Yorker. Even though he's from North Carolina, in his heart he was Mr. New York. He hung out at all the same bars as us, Niagara and Black and White. He was a big Strokes fan. He used to call them the famous-as-fuck Strokes, like, oh, how are the famous-as-fuck Strokes doing? They're famous-as-fuck. That's how he referred to them, because he's obsessed with these kinds of things. Jesse Mallon. I remember being in a card game at Ryan Gentles' house at 7 in the morning with the Strokes guys. Ryan and John Mayer showed up. He was the only one sober. He beat everyone's ass at the table. Ryan Adams. One night, I was hanging out with the Strokes guys and Ryan. We were really stoned because we were basically always smoking pot. It was very late. Fab would always play me a song that he had written. Some beautiful romantic song. So one night, jokingly, I'm almost certain Fabby said, "Dude, what if John Mayer was playing that guitar right now?" And I said, "I can make that happen." And they all said, "You're full of shit." I said, "Give me 3 fucking beers," because there was only so many beers left at that late hour, "and I'll make it happen. I'm a goddamn genie in a bottle." And we died laughing. Now, I live down the block from John Mayer, and he'd been talking to me about his new song for a while. So I texted him, because he was always up late back then. I said, "Come to this apartment, bring an acoustic guitar. I really want to hear your new song." I didn't tell them that I'd done it. So everyone is sitting there, and I was like, "Let's all take bong hits." I really wanted it to get crazy. We smoked some bong hits. I probably did some blow. I started to drink my 3 beers. The doorbell buzzer rings, and I open the door, and John Mayer walks in with his fucking acoustic guitar, and they were all slack-jawed. John sat down and played the fucking acoustic guitar, 3 or 4 songs that probably have gone on to be huge, while those guys just sat there staring at me like, "Oh my God, you're a witch." The next day, John was like, "Hey man, next time maybe less cigarette smoke? That really hurt my throat." That apartment was like an airport smoking lounge. Gideon Yego. Ryan Adams. He was one of those guys where I just remember being like, "I just don't know. I didn't take to him very well." I mean, that to me was the beginning of the end. He was a dude in an alt-country band who moved to New York and totally co-opted all of the Strokes' albums. Ryan Gentles. The Strokes had a clause in their contract that I would be their exclusive manager for the first 5 years. And because we were all starting out with no experience, I was like, "Sure." Then I asked them if I could manage other artists. They said, "Yeah." I took on Moldy Peaches and Ryan Adams. Albert Hammond Jr. Ryan got close to him. Ryan and Ryan. A little R&R. And I was also friendly with him. Fabrizio Moretti. He would come over to our apartment a lot. And I remember him playing a lot of songs. He was always willing to play a song. Albert Hammond Jr. When he shows you a song, he doesn't stop for hours. You're like, "Oh, that reminds me of a song I wrote." And you grab and play a G chord, and he's like, "I know what you're talking about," and he grabs the guitar back. There's no way to play music with him. It's the Ryan show always. Where most people, if someone was getting on their nerves like that, would be like, "Stop." I would just take it for as long as I could. Ryan Gentles. I introduced Jim Barber and Ryan Adams. Courtney Love was dating Jim at the time. James Barber. Courtney thought the Strokes were a positive cultural influence. She was doing this MTV special, and she wanted them on. Mark Spitz. She was like their Yoda, their Coke Yoda. I'm not saying she gave them cocaine. I mean, most everyone was on cocaine. But it seemed like as soon as they really made it, she was all over them. And she was not in the best shape at the time. Maybe not the Jedi you want whispering in your ear about how to be a rock star. Ryan Gentles. I was friends with Courtney. She would call me at random hours to give me advice. I'd be shopping for groceries and my phone would ring. Ryan, it's Courtney. We need to talk. I read this article. It was that kind of thing. Then she did this overnight broadcast thing for MTV. Mark Spitz. It was called 24 Hours of Love. And the premise was that she would take over the MTV soundstage, the one in Times Square, for 24 hours. It was set up like an apartment, with a bed and shit. Albert Hammond Jr. We were just out late one night with Ryan Adams, and someone said, "Oh yeah, Courtney Love's doing this thing. Do you want to go?" I said, "Sure." Ryan Gentles. I thought, great, a chance to get on MTV. It's hard to get on MTV. I was like, great. Another way to infiltrate the Christina Aguilera world. It was a total disaster. Manager fail. Fabrizio Moretti. All I remember is being in bed with Albert. Albert Hammond Jr. It was just weird. She and Ryan were just doing their thing. What Ryan always does. Talk and play. Fab and I were just like extras in a movie, which we were fine with. It was kind of fun. It wears off, though. Ryan Gentles. Ryan stole the spotlight, because Ryan loves the camera, and my guys do not. Ryan was like, "Let me play you some songs." He loved it. Ryan Adams. I was so sick, ironically. I was sick and I was on a bunch of meds. I told them, I was like, "Dude, I'm really not feeling good." And they were like, "You have to go with us. We don't want to go if you don't go. We're scared." They talked me into it. Albert Hammond Jr. When you're fucked up and the idea is funny, you just do it. It's almost like when I was a kid and I was like, it would be great to take acid and go to the Pajama Jamma Jam at school. And then you get to school and you're like, why did I think this was such a good idea? You have to have a 20-minute talk with your dean and you're trying to hold it together. Same thing. You're like, oh yeah, we'll go up there and hang out with Courtney Love. By the time you're in a taxi and you're in traffic and you're like, wait, what are we doing here? Ryan Gentles. She was all strung out and drunk. It was almost embarrassing. She was running up and down the hallways naked. She tried to make out with people, strangers. Albert Hammond Jr. Oh, she was fucked up. You could see the makeup while they were filming. It was like her nose was just falling apart. Someone was making sure she was decent. It was just gross. It was dark. It wasn't fun. It was just the coldest environment possible. Fucking Ryan Adams and Courtney Love, man. Ryan Gentles. I actually adore her in a way. She's so smart. But I don't know her. I don't think anybody knows her.
Jenny Eliscu. Gentles briefly managed Ryan Adams during that era, which seemed to not go great.
Ryan Gentles. Ryan and I were buds, and we went down to New Orleans and made love as hell. Then I had to quit because the Strokes exercised a clause in their contract that said I wasn't allowed to manage other artists. Fabrizio Moretti. I remember the band feeling jealous about Ryan paying attention to anybody other than us. And there was a sense that Ryan's success was built on our backs a little bit. He didn't plan to be a manager. He kind of fell into it because he was the liaison between us and Jeff Travis. He was coming up with us as if he was part of the band. So why would he be able to have sex with other people if we weren't allowed to? You know what I mean? In this marriage. Nick Valenci. Look, Ryan, when he first started managing us, had zero experience managing anything. Basically, Ryan was learning as he was going, as we all were. But as a result of that, naturally there would be times when Ryan would drop the ball a little bit. And there would be things that he just didn't know. Situations he didn't know how to handle, which is understandable. But then when he also took on other clients, other artists like Ryan Adams, Adam Green, he started dropping the ball a little bit more. Dave Gottlieb. You can't know what you don't know. Brian Long. Yeah. There was a lot of consternation that this kid was managing the Strokes and didn't know what the hell he was doing. But I thought it was kind of cool, kind of punk rock. Jim Merlis. Ryan was in a very tough spot, as he is today. He's hired because Julian wants him there. He can't go against him. Even if Ryan knows better, there's nothing he can do. He's in a really fucked up situation. Anyone else would have gotten fired, you know what I mean? But he's still there. Ryan Gentles. They feel like I skew my favor toward Julian. He's the guy with the vision and writes all the fucking songs. It's like, what do you mean? If he quits, there's no band tomorrow. But if somebody else quits, you can probably find a replacement. And that's not being mean to them. They all say it too. Those were the early days, when they were all still young and nobody was famous yet. Now, after they've had success, I think everyone in the band knows that and feels that way about Jules. I think they all know this guy has the vision, and he has something that's intangible, and you just have to go with it. And you don't always have to agree with it or see what he sees. Also, they know me as an outsider, still. We've been together all these years, but they've known each other since they were fucking five. When it's the six of us, I'm the outsider. I'm still the new guy. Albert Hammond Jr. Julian had a very clear thing, and we like to do things a certain way. I think a lot of things they might blame Ryan for is stuff the band just doesn't want to do. Ryan Gentles. Do you know how many times I begged the Strokes to do some shit, and they just said no, and it was idiotic, and everyone in the world knows they should do it? The band sometimes just said, no, we know better. You're an advisor. They're the stars. We work for them.
Amanda de Cadenet. They're the band that turned down $1 million for some Heineken ad. That's dumb.
Dave Gottlieb. We got a request from Heineken, for it was either Hard to Explain or Last Night. I think it was Last Night. It was $600,000.
Amanda de Cadenet. Ryan has taken a lot of flack for not being able to do things that we all think they should have done. But nobody can get these fuckers to do anything they don't want to do. You can have manager skills up the ass. It's not going to mean anything to this band. They do whatever the fuck they want to do.
Ryan Gentles. By 2002, it was clear who the boss was. And it wasn't me. Gideon Yeago. Honestly, nobody knew what they were doing. It was like you had these kids who had read Andrew Luke Oldham while stoned, and maybe owned a copy of Donald Passman's All You Need to Know About the Music Business. They were all glorified fans. Ryan Gentles. When they were making Room on Fire, they said they felt my attention wasn't all theirs. They wanted the office to be their clubhouse and said, you have to stop managing Ryan Adams. It sucked. He's super talented and I was ambitious and I liked his music a lot, and I still do. How did he take it? He took it real bad. Chapter 54. A hi-hat is like working with a seller of exotic wines. Harmar Superstar. They were so mythical. Jim Merlis. I remember being in a bar on Houston Street, and the bartender said, are you Jim Merlis? And I said, yeah. And he said, I've heard about you. You're a publicist. Yeah? I play in a band. Drinks are on the house here. It happened again at 2A. People knew who I was. I was getting a lot of demos, and even the bands I was taking on, I was like, you know it's not going to be like that, right? It's not me, it's them. It's hard to put it into proper context. A band like Interpol, or later Vampire Weekend, it was nothing compared to what happened with the Strokes. Nothing. Nick Valenci. There's something very cool about being a part of the thing that helped open the door. Being the first one in the room is very exciting. But what inevitably happens is other people show up and end up having way more success than you do. Being the leader of the herd, you're probably going to die. You really want to be middle of the pack. The first one in the herd doesn't make it, generally. That's the metaphor. Ryan Gentles. As soon as Is This It came out, it made them feel like we had to put out another record right away. They wanted to go into the studio immediately and fire it out. They didn't want to be like a lot of bands who come and go and you only know their one record. So they rushed into writing and making Room on Fire. Mark Spitz. Ryan was trying to keep things together, run this ship, but it was clearly like a bigger boat than he'd ever captained before. In 2002, on that last tour for Is This It, you felt eyes on you that weren't there. They were being watched, and they knew they were being watched. They were watching me, I was watching them. The record company was watching all of us. The world was watching the movement to see if it was bullshit. But in hindsight, I realized why the label was there. It was not about Is This It. That record had been out for over a year. It was about what's next. It was about Room on Fire. Steve Ralbovsky. I like to go visit my bands on tour stops. It gives us a chance to catch up and have a late afternoon or evening before a show to kind of go over the current laundry list of stuff to do with whatever part of the cycle you're in. I met them on the road in Portland. I wanted to initiate a conversation about the next record. What about somebody other than Gordon? Knowing full well that they and he would want to control the proceedings. And frankly, they kind of earned the right to do it their own way. So we're having this conversation at a little bar, having a little smoke break outside. And I mentioned Rick Ocasek of the Cars, because I knew Albert loved them. Then we went back inside to the table. Julian sat back down, and I said, "What about this guy Nigel Godrich?" Nigel Godrich could do no wrong. He worked with Beck, and he worked with Radiohead. Julian said, "You mean the guy that does Radiohead? He would work with us?" I said, "Yeah, we can ask." Gordon Raphael. I went to a meeting in New York at the WizKid management office right before they were making Room on Fire, and I saw Nigel Godrich's name on a board, and I got really jealous. I was heartbroken. I said, "Julian, are you going to record with Nigel?" He said, "Yeah, we want to see if we can get a Radiohead sound. Their sound is so great." Steve Ralbovsky. The tryout lasted 10 days. They worked on Meet Me in the Bathroom and one or two other songs. It was just so hard going method-wise for Nigel. He wanted to record a certain way, and Julian wanted to record a certain way. Nigel was more of a let's just record it as a band and we'll subtract and add later on. Julian wanted to get every instrument individually recorded and then layered. So the methods were conflicting. J.P. Bowersock. They were using the digital technology. Nigel is a brilliant tape splicer. You couldn't ask for anyone better to get the Strokes, who operate in a digital mode to record on tape. It seemed like such a good idea on paper, but the working methods were completely different. Jim Merlis. Steve has hilarious stories about JP coming into the studio and it not sounding good, and JP coming up with theories about the certain sound waves, and the band was like, "Yes, yes." Steve Ralbovsky. JP would kind of stand over Nigel's shoulder and say, "You know, this isn't really how we do it." JP Bowersock. I came to every day of the session, and Nigel would not let me in the control room because he didn't want anybody looking over his shoulder. He's Mr. Hot Shit Producer, correct? You are Mr. Hot Shit Producer. My respect for you is toweringly huge, but I could translate to you what the Strokes are asking for. He wanted none of it. Jim Merlis. Nigel was like, "Who is that guy?" Disaster. Gordon Raphael. Recording the drums, Julian said, "I really like your drum sound, but can we work on the hi-hat?" Julian told me that Nigel said, "Julian, a hi-hat's a hi-hat." Now, I know from working with Julian that for him a hi-hat is like working with a seller of exotic wines from all over the world. Do you want that one? Or maybe that one? Smell the bouquet. A hi-hat for him was worthy of days of tweaking. That's all that Nigel Godrich said. And the next day, we were on the phone, and right after that, I was flying over from London to start recording. I don't know if it's true, but that's what they told me. Steve Ralbovsky. Poor Nigel Godrich was in a state. He didn't want to let anybody down, but he felt like maybe they're not ready. Maybe I'm not the right guy for it. We had lunch in Soho one day, and he said, I just don't think I can do it. He was really emotional, really upset about it. I said, it's not going to work. You gave it your best, and they just really weren't ready for it. They just weren't ready. They had to do it themselves. Jim Merlis. I'd love to hear what those Nigel Godrich recordings sounded like. I never even heard it. I think Steve heard it, and Steve said it was great. J.P. Bowersock. When they finally parted ways with Nigel, we all went bowling. I said to Nigel, dude, I would have loved to have been a resource for you. But that was just foreign to his way of working. Steve Ralbovsky. So it was back to Gordon. At a different studio. Chapter 55. Heroin just kind of crosses a line. James Barber. I was in the studio with Ryan Adams making Rock and Roll when all of that went down between him and Ryan Gentles. Ryan Adams, he was pissed off. Ryan Adams. There was nothing unfair about it. I didn't have a contract with Ryan. We were just working on good faith, and that's how I work with everybody. I don't do contracts. James Barber. There was no other way it could happen, though, because Ryan was not going to change his business relationship with the Strokes. He was vested. But it definitely was fuel for Ryan Adams. Like, I'm going to show the Strokes. You guys want a New York rock record? Here's a New York rock record. Ryan Gentles. Ryan Adams thought the Strokes hated me and said I should have fought to keep managing him. But you know, they did him a favor. Ryan, I loved him, and now he's sober. I'm sure he's a different guy. But back then, it was pills and everything. Forget it. Just up all night. Wanted you to be at his disposal. Mark Spitz. Ryan was working on his follow-up to Gold. He had no idea what kind of record he wanted to make. He was down in New Orleans, and Spin sent me there to profile him. We got down there, and it's just a mess. He was just high. In New Orleans, the bars never close, so we could get out of the studio at 4 and go to a bar. No matter what bar we walked into, the bartender would go, oh, hey, Ryan. So we know that he'd been here before. And he would have all these, like, these little greasy bags of shitty coke. There's probably, like, 9% coke in there. But, like, all that 9% plus the 91% of whatever else was in there was in his bloodstream, you know? Fucking up his record. Ryan seemed haunted and really self-destructive in an almost gleeful way. Like, I saw him literally running through the streets of the French Quarter at 5 in the morning with the sun coming up singing Frère Jacques at the top of his lungs. Something in his head was chasing him. Ryan Gentles. He needed a team of managers working around the clock for him, and I didn't have that kind of operation. Mark Spitz. Do you know that scene in Manhattan where Yale is breaking up with Diane Keaton? And she goes, right, I understand. I could tell by the sound of your voice over the phone. Very authoritative, you know. Like the Pope, or the computer in 2001. I love Ryan Gentles, but that's kind of like what he was. He was like Neville Chamberlain, ceding all this power to Hitler. Sure, you want Eastern Europe? Just take it.
Catherine Pierce. Julian thought Ryan was a bad influence on Albert.
Albert Hammond Jr. Ryan would always come and wake me up at 2 in the morning and have drugs, so I'd just do the drugs and kind of numb out.
Catherine Pierce. That apartment was 2 levels. Albert and I were on the upper level. Julian and Colleen were on the lower level. And there was an odd cutout in the floor. This strip, maybe, where there was supposed to be a heating vent or something. A long strip. You could look down and be like, "Hey, guys." You could hear everything. I could hear him whispering sweet nothings to her in the morning. It was cute. And they probably heard Albert and me fighting like cats and dogs because he was an addict and I was trying to stop it. And